Good afternoon, everybody. This is Mike Westerdahl from CriticalBench.com. This is your weekly muscle building expert interview series, and boy, do I have an expert in store for you guys today. On the interview tonight, we've got Mike T. Nelson. He's a certified strength and conditioning specialist, and he's also a PhD candidate at University of Minnesota. He comes to us from his blog and from his website, ExtremeHumanPerformance.com. He spent over 16 years in school studying everything that has to do with exercise and physiology. So this is going to be an exciting phone call tonight. We got a lot of ground to cover, and we're going to talk about how to set personal records, how to do physique transformations, all at the same time staying strong and staying lean. So we got a lot of stuff to talk about. Welcome to the call, Mike. Thanks a lot for taking time out of your busy schedule for us. You've got quite a bit of credentials and things. Why don't you just give everybody a little background about yourself, anything I might have left out?
Oh, yeah. No, thank you very much. It's an honor and a privilege to do calls like this. I always enjoy it. Yeah, correct. I did initially a Bachelor of Arts, Natural Science, in St. Scholastica in Duluth. And then actually I decided I went on and did a Master's in Mechanical Engineering at Michigan Tech. Before I ended up going back to school again, did a short stint in the PhD program in biomed, and then ended up switching to where I'm at currently in exercise physiology. So my main work is on, we'll probably talk about metabolic flexibility, and I also did a study on energy drinks, so that's kind of interest too.
And I'm drinking one right now.
Oh no! yeah. And I'm working on a book on, just a chapter in a book all about protein metabolism, so working on some case studies for that. So, yeah.
All right, cool. Then you're, are you training people right now, too, or are you just totally busy with the academics?
I do have some people from online clients to, various consulting. I do have some people that, I used to work at a commercial gym, and to be perfectly honest, for myself, my personality drove me just bonkers. So I end up just training people out of my garage now, which is so nice.
That's
like
cool.
They just come over and I can do whatever I want. And, if it works,
exactly.
Great. Then if it doesn't, well, then that's my fault and I better figure it out really fast.
Yeah, and I'm sure you will without some corporate people telling you you're not hitting your quotas and you're doing it wrong.
Sounds
like much more fun training people on your own. I know how you feel. I worked as a trainer at commercial gyms too.
Yeah, it's great on you.
So what exactly is movement coaching? That was one of the services that you said you provide your clients with.
Yeah, I guess everything I do is based off of movement. And not that I'm, an expert at, helping someone with their golf swing or basketball shot or whatever. But, most people are just, take golf, for example, are just trying to get better. So if you watch their golf swing, you can say, oh, well, maybe you should try this or maybe you should try that. A buddy of mine, Frankie, says it's just as simple as watching them and trying to notice what doesn't move. If you can find that, then usually you can see a pretty big increase in their performance. And, it's the same thing like, with bench press or squat or deadlift. There's obviously technique that's involved. And by watching people, it gives you a pretty good idea of, different things you should try. So I consider all those are just movement-based.
So performance-based, you work mostly with athletes or people that are trying to develop strength?
Most of the people are just the average person trying to make, physique transformations. Guys looking to increase strength and, drop some fat. And, women, that's pretty similar, although women are usually more, for lack of a better word, size-orientated. Most women are looking more for fat loss and aren't really as concerned about strength initially. So.
Right. That makes sense. Does that lead into the metabolic flexibility that you're going to tell us a little bit about?
Yeah. So that's probably a term no one has really heard of before, and there's some research that's been around for, quite a while now. But at the simplest level, like if we look at someone who is a diabetic, right? So we know diabetics have a very hard time processing carbohydrates. So they're very metabolically inflexible to carbohydrates. They have a hard time using them, causes all sorts of other gummed up machinery in their body. So if you look at someone who's very healthy, on the other side of the scale, they should be able to use carbohydrates very efficiently. So therefore, they would be very metabolically flexible to carbohydrates. And the other main fuel source, as we know, is fat. That can be body fat, or that can be fat that's taken in food. And there are some people who, you know, have a hard time metabolically processing fat. On the flip side, you want someone who's very metabolically flexible to using fat. So the timing of it is what's really important. So if you're really walking around during your, you know, everyday life, you're not training, you really want to be using primarily body fat to fuel those activities. If you do some form of high-intensity training, which, you know, can be weight training or sprints or athletic performance, at that point, you most of the time, for very high intensity, you want to be using carbohydrates. And what we found is that there's actually some people who that's almost reversed. Their body is still trying to burn more carbohydrates at rest, but they then have to take in even more carbohydrates under high-intensity exercise. So in the perfect world, go ahead.
Well, how do you determine, how can you tell, you know, what they're using for fuel?
If you do in a laboratory setting, which, you know, obviously not everyone's going to have access to, the simplest thing to look at is what's called the respiratory exchange ratio, or it's called the RER. And if you go into a lab, they stuff this, you know, thing in your mouth that measures all the air that you expire. And by the machine analyzing that, it'll give you a little number for each breath they take. And that'll tell you at that point percentage of fat, percentage of carbohydrates. For people who don't have access to laboratory equipment, which is most of the people, a lot of times it's just as simple as paying attention to how you feel, how's your mood, how's your performance. So if I get up and I have, you know, breakfast and I have mostly fat and some protein, how do I feel after that? If I had pancakes, I feel like I'm going to, you know, fall asleep and my face is going to end up on the pancakes by the end of the meal, or do I feel pretty good?
Right.
The other main condition is training. Some people do very well having, a protein carbohydrate beverage before or during training. Other people, not so well. If you go to the endurance side, which probably isn't really very many people on this call, but those people a lot of times have to take in tons of carbohydrates during events, and that may actually cause some, you know, gastrointestinal issues, don't feel very good because of the long-duration exercise. So the short answer is there's no perfect indicator. It's a little bit of, you know, initially playing around with it and seeing how your body responds to it.
Now, is that similar to people that are carb types or protein types? How some people think everyone has a unique metabolism where they respond differently to different foods. That's why one diet isn't necessarily going to work for everybody. Does that tie into this at all?
Yeah, it's very similar with a catch. It's similar that people can I'll just get another call there. It's similar in the fact that we've got. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Just bleeped
okay,
out
cool.
for a second.
It's similar to the fact that you've got people who say, hey, I did this low-carbohydrate diet, and, man, I feel awesome. Woohoo! And then you've got other people that are like, well, I thought I was going to die. I didn't feel very good at all. So there is definitely people that are sort of preset towards those two different conditions. My thought is that, in general, you'd want to be able to have the potential to do both at the correct time. So say, for example, you're not training and you want to sort of minimize body fat. At the simplest level, you want to teach your body to burn fat at that point. One of the easy ways to do that is to increase the amount of fat coming in your diet. Under exercise, though, if you're doing high-intensity exercise, you still want to be able to tap into stored carbohydrate stores like glycogen and that type of thing to perform the exercise. So you really want to be able to switch depending upon the activity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it
does. So you're using the fuel source at the right time.
So I guess I'm wondering, is the right time pre-workout, or could that be before or earlier in the day? Or what are the different timings? When are the times that you want to eat?
Sure. For most people, in general, it involves, you know, lower carbohydrate diets during most of the time. And then if they're doing like weight training or sprints or intervals, at that point, pre-training, they can use like a protein carbohydrate beverage, assuming they don't have any, you know, intestinal gastral issues with it. And that can be timed everything from an hour before, half hour before, and maybe sip on that during. And then if they're really trying to gain mass or size, yeah, definitely having one once they're done training is probably good. If they're really trying to preserve lean body mass but trying to cut body fat, probably just going back to more just protein post-training is probably going to be a little bit better.
Okay, that makes sense.
And again, that's reducing calories a little bit too. And most people aren't going to compete and do another event until the next day. So
right.
If your calories are, you know, pretty close to where they should be, your glycogen or your fuel stores will be pretty close to normal the next day. There's no real need to eat a boatload of carbohydrates the hour post-training,
right.
Especially if your next session isn't for 24 hours. If you're doing two-a-day, you know, if you're a football player and you're doing two-a-days, then there may be some benefit there. But for the average person going to the gym, probably not really needed.
Do you believe in that 30-minute window where you can get some sugars right after a workout? That's kind of a controversial issue.
Yeah, the whole timing issue is really interesting. There is some literature to show that post-training for carbohydrates, that if you can refuel them faster, that you can probably, you know, refuel the glycogen stores sooner. And that'll probably be beneficial if you have another practice later in the day. So maybe you're like an American football player where you've got, you know, your skill session and your strength sessions are both in the same day, you know, separated by 2 to 5 hours or whatever. Then,
right.
Yeah, at that point, a fast carbohydrate like Botargo or something like that is definitely going to be beneficial. If you're the average person where you're just doing another session, maybe 24, 48 hours later, it's probably not going to make that much of a difference, especially if your calories coming in are enough to cover it. Your body's pretty smart, and it'll take those calories and convert them to glycogen, so you'll still be okay.
Okay. So when you were describing metabolic flexibility, I saw you said teaching the body to burn fat to fuel muscle growth. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. So if we look at, let's say you go in and you have a really heavy strength training session, we know that metabolic rate can be elevated for 24, maybe in some studies showed 48 hours. And the cool part is that in a perfect world, now this doesn't happen perfectly, you'd want your body to pull body fat to sort of fuel that process, right? So
right.
That you could miraculously increase muscle mass and decrease body fat all the time. And that can happen to some degree. It's a little bit trickier to do. So we know from research that if you look at high-intensity sprints, that's what they call the EPOC, you know, post-exercise oxygen consumption, that the payback is primarily fat burning. So that once you're done, your body is trying to get back to sort of its baseline level, and it does that primarily by using body fat. So it isn't that much of a stretch to think that under weight training, which is, you know, still a pretty high-intensity event, that your body, if you're teaching it to use fat, could use that to increase the size of the muscles then too. Does that kind of make a little more sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I mean, if it works for one, it would only make sense. The same thing could happen during weight training.
Yeah, so you'd want to be taking fat and using that as a calories to increase muscle.
Hmm. Yeah, that's good to know that there's potential for that.
Yeah, the hard part is, to be perfectly honest, it's kind of a buzzkill, is that the body doesn't always perfectly operate like that. If it did, you would see people gaining huge amounts of muscles and dropping fat really fast. Yeah, you can sort of kind of edge it and try to push it towards that direction a little bit more.
Yeah, what are some of the variables, do you think, that make it inconsistent?
Yeah, it seems to be probably getting people to use body fat or just fat initially, like we said before, easiest way to do that is to probably increase the amount of fat that you're have coming in as a fuel source. Now, if you have people who are primarily using carbohydrates, initially when you get them to sort of switch, they don't feel very good.
Yeah.
It's like if you take anyone and say, okay, tomorrow you're having no carbohydrates. We're putting you on a strict ketogenic diet, and here we go. Well, some of those people don't feel very good for the first couple of days, even weeks. But then most of the time, your body then adapts to it, and you're okay with it. So slowly getting them to use body fat, like that's one method of doing it. Maybe beneficial exercise, if you can get a higher volume of exercise, that definitely seems to help. It's not really shown that if I exercise, let's say, one day, and I have an increase, let's say, for 24 to 48 hours, and I go tomorrow, do I get a further increase? Is it that much higher? Probably higher, but we don't know exactly how much. So exercising, the anecdotal cutoff seems to be about 5 hours a week, maybe beneficial. Beyond that, related a little bit, which is more advanced, to tissue turnover. If you can do more volume and you can do it at a faster speed, that may be more incentive for your body to sort of replace the older, not as well equipped muscle with new, better muscle, so that you're turning over that muscle tissue faster, and that should equate to burning a few more calories. There are some studies showing that if you increase the intake of protein, your body will then oxidize more protein, so it'll break down more protein. And I think overall that's probably a good thing, so that you're building up more and you're tearing down more at the same time. Sort of like a little bit like faster remodeling. So.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. So kind of doing faster workouts, maybe more supersetting and just getting more volume in. So you can lift more total weight, just try to get it done faster. That might be more beneficial than moving the same weight in a 2 or 3 hour time span.
Yeah, and that's kind of related to the density, you know, how much work per volume you're doing. And anecdotally, it seems to relate also to the speed of the movement. So if you're doing, like, say, you know, kettlebell clean and jerk or something like that, where you're doing a fair amount of reps at a pretty fast speed, that seems to be beneficial too also. Or if you're doing, you know, a moderate load, but you're moving it relatively fast. Because we know that speed in general can be pretty threatening. If I took a plate and I just set it on your big toe, that's going to be all right. But now I hold it up to about your knee level and I want to drop it on your big toe, big difference, right?
Yeah.
So that by moving an implement faster, we can create a little bit more stress on the tissue also.
Okay. Yeah, in powerlifting, we try to move the weight as fast as possible. It just doesn't always move fast when you have a lot of weight on there. But there are those.
You're lifting those heavy-ass weights.
But then you have your speed training, too, though, and those explosive reps could be more beneficial for the physique transformation part.
Yeah, definitely, I think so. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, and like you said, trying to get people to eat more fat, that's a tough thing with society and everything you read around, people talking about how bad fat is for you, even though, you know, you and I know you need fats and it's not necessarily as bad for you as everybody makes it seem. So probably
hard to
convince your clients it's okay to eat fats, and they've been hearing their whole life that it's going to give them high cholesterol and all kinds of other problems.
Oh, yeah. It's not to stereotype women, but women seem to be probably more because the media that they read and that kind of stuff are, you know, really convinced. And some guys, too, like you said, fat's just evil and,
Yeah, it's horrible. Well, I mean, we have a friend who's not listening to this call, and they have I hope at least, but they have a baby, and they're not feeding it any fat. They're putting it on, like, a fat-free diet. And
oh, my God.
It's horrible, and the kid is so light compared to how big he should be at this time.
Oh, yeah. And
you know, those stereotypes, people just thinking fat's bad for you.
Yeah.
It's very
especially
important.
Especially for growth and development. And,
yep.
Yeah, especially like fish oils have been shown, DHA for even the simple nervous system and brain development, especially when kids are growing, is hugely important. But anyway.
Kind of getting off topic, but
yeah.
Was there anything else you wanted to say about metabolic flexibility, or do you want to talk about the energy drink study you did?
Sure. Yeah, the last thing on metabolic flexibility is that it all boils down to that I think in general people have their idea of dieting is sort of backwards. So they all think, okay, you know, let's say a new client comes in is overweight, and you tell them, all right, we can help you with that, but you're going to eat chicken and broccoli, and it's going to be you're going to eat that for the rest of your life. They're going to go running and screaming out the door, and you'll probably never see them again.
Yeah.
So in general, the fitness culture is that you have to be, you know, sort of suffer more than the next guy, and I'm going to eat chicken and broccoli 99% of my meals. And, you know, and yeah, some of that stuff can work, but again, it can work at what cost? So what I have people do is that the end goal, once you're at a maintenance phase of, you know, whatever you want your body composition to be at, your whole goal at that point is to see how many sort of quote unquote bad foods and stuff you can eat and actually get away with it. You know, your goal
right.
at that point is to see, can you be 80% compliant, 70% compliant, 60% compliant? You know, to me, that's much more of a healthier outlook. You know, so if you go out to dinner one night or two nights or whatever, and yeah, it doesn't affect you, your body processes everything just fine. That's cool. That, I mean, I think that's one of the end goal instead of saying, oh, my God, I didn't have my chicken and broccoli today, and I ate a muffin, and, oh, it was horrible. You know, it's like,
yes.
Yeah.
Then, you know, if you're on too strict of a diet always, sometimes you'll see that lead to people just totally binging, pigging out.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you know any bodybuilders that have, you know, done a show.
Oh.
And they've been so
strict
for 12 weeks that they go and put on like 15, 20 pounds right after the competition just because they eat everything. I mean, just human nature, if you're depriving yourself, eventually you're just going to crack. So why not try to have some of those cheat meals? And I guess you have to be more strict when you're trying to get to your goal, right? But once you hit it, like you said, and you want to maintain, that's when you kind of want to see, you know, what you can eat and can't eat. And it's, you know, there's foods that for body composition and health, I think that's two different things sometimes. There's foods you might gain a little bit of body fat from them, but they're still good for you. So that's a balance too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Well, speaking of healthy, all right, I'm done with my my energy drink.
Oh, which one was it?
Now let me know what's going to happen to me.
That
was a sugar-free Red Bull. And
I know
the stimulants aren't good. I know the artificial sweetener is not good. So give me the rundown. What are your findings?
Yeah. So I initially looked at it at first to see how I was doing a study that was related to metabolic flexibility. And so we had to use an intervention where we didn't have no calories for the one group. And the other group, we were primarily basing it off of a carbohydrate beverage. And there's tons of stuff in the literature on, you know, Gatorade and carbohydrate beverages. And I'm like, yeah, that's not very interesting. I'm like, well, what happens if we use an energy drink? That'd be way more interesting. And then also, in terms of getting it published, using an energy drink makes it a little bit more new and novel. So if the results kind of all turn out negative, then you go, well, you know, okay, it's got an energy drink, so that's kind of new and sexy. Maybe we'll still publish them anyway. So what we're looking at is exercise performance on a ride to exhaustion. So get on a bike and just keep exercising until you can't exercise anymore. We also looked at heart rate variability, which is a way to measure the nervous system. So it's a ratio of parasympathetic to sympathetic activation. So parasympathetic being sort of the rest and digest branch of the nervous system. And sympathetic being the autonomic nervous system. And sympathetic being the fight or flight. So we wanted to measure that, you know, at rest after an energy drink. Looked at heart rate. We looked at some stuff called flow-mediated dilation, which is just a fancy way of looking at blood flow. So how does your body and vessels respond to that? And the short answer is that I'm in the process of writing up the studies, so the results from that will be hopefully coming out pretty soon. If we look at some of the other literature, it's pretty split. There's some stuff showing that, you know, because of the caffeine and the stimulants, that it does benefit exercise. There's also, you know, carbohydrates in it. Other stuff shows that, no, it doesn't really benefit all that much, especially if we, you know, give someone a carbohydrate. So then we're just looking at the fact that maybe the caffeine, the other components in it, in terms of like the taurine, doesn't seem to affect performance at all. Caffeine in high enough doses does help performance, especially endurance performance. But for a typical male, you're looking at a dose of, you know, 200, maybe 400, maybe even 600 milligrams. So like an 8-ounce cup of coffee is maybe 120 milligrams. Although now you can go to Starbucks and get like a, you know, freaking grande, whatever, that's got, you know, 400 or 500 milligrams, you know. So it's pretty well split. I mean, it, you know, everyone always cries and goes, wow, there's no safety data. Whoa, what's going on with that? And there's not a lot of long-term studies per se on energy drinks. Even the acute ones, there's one that showed, you know, maybe heart rate went up and blood pressure went up. But if I remember that study correct, they gave, I think it was college students, two cans. I think it was Red Bull. I could be wrong on that. Two cans a day for 7 days. And then, you know, measured them on the seventh day.
Mixed it with vodka for them, too?
Yeah, they actually have done studies on that, too. Because it's, you know, on one hand, it's like, hey, what happens when we put a stimulant like caffeine in it, and then we put something like a depressant like alcohol? What happens then?
you get drunk and stay awake.
Yeah, that's about it. You have a bunch of buddies of mine when I graduated college the first go round. You know, vodka Red Bull was like brand new, so they, you know, drank me out to bars with them and stuff. And I didn't have that many of them just because I was, you know, piss poor and couldn't afford it, to be perfectly honest. And oh my God, it was like so weird. There's these people that are just drunk out of their minds and just wired at the same time, like running around, and it's quite interesting to say the least.
It's funny.
So, it's safety data, yeah, hard to say. I mean, I think the biggest problem is that, you know, a lot of kids will have an energy drink in place of something else. You know, oh, I got a hockey game coming up. Well, it'll be fine. I don't need to eat anything. I'll just have a Red Bull or a Monster or whatever. So it's not only do you have the fact of the energy drink in the equation, you've now actually had the energy drink sort of displace out what they would have normally potentially eaten. So,
and you kind of think they work better as, or they're kind of in this category as a supplement, where some people use their protein shakes instead of a meal, when really it should just be for convenience or kind of something prior to or during a workout. It shouldn't be something that replaces regular solid food.
Right, yeah. So yeah, it's one thing to say, okay, I took a protein supplement, didn't have time to eat a chicken breast or whatever. Okay, you know, that's not that far removed, you know. They're both protein, you know, okay. But now you're saying that, well, you know, I had an energy drink, which is just caffeine and sugar in place of a normal meal I was going to eat. Now you're really stretching it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sugar in those normal ones, like the regular Monsters, those big ones. They have, like, the gas tank top to them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't remember. Maybe there might be, like, 40, 50 grams of sugar in there or something.
Yeah, it's pretty high. And, you know, most of them are, you know, 2 to 3 servings a can. And, you know, no kid drinks, like, half a can, leaves the other half there, you know. I mean,
right.
That doesn't happen.
So you got to get some kind of sugar rush or plus the caffeine. I mean, I guess I could definitely see some of the tests showing some kind of increase in at least some of the measurements, but I don't know if that equals a better workout or not.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. So the question is, did your performance increase, or do you think your performance increased because you feel better?
Right, like you feel flushed, you feel awake.
Yeah.
But then you're just lifting the same weight. You can't run any faster.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that happens more often than not, you know, and caffeine does have what they call some ergogenic benefit for sure. But, for example, if you look at a study on people who would swing they put the heavy donut on their baseball bat and do a couple of warm-up swings with that, So I did a study and said, okay, so you're going to use a weighted donut here, then swing a normal bat. Other group, nope, no weighted donut, just normal bat swing, and then have at it. What they found is that if you added the weight to their bat, the players thought that they were swinging the unweighted bat faster. And when they measured it, nope, it was actually slower. So a lot of times you can't entirely rely on, you know, how you feel per se. Now, a lot of times it is related to performance, but a lot of times it might not be. So
it can almost go into some sports psychology where if you feel better and you think you're doing better than you are, you will do better versus someone who might not be thinking as positively.
Oh, yeah, and there's no question that your beliefs and, you know, what you think affect your performance and all that kind of stuff, but you just need to make sure that you're, as simple as it sounds, you're actually measuring your performance.
Right. I mean, you might as well just do some meditation or visualization instead of using the ring on the bat. You'd get the same effect.
Oh, yeah.
It's not necessarily the ring.
Yeah, and you'd probably do better, right? Because now you're not having that sort of altered motor response. You know, we have.
Yeah, that's true.
I'll go on another topic, but motor learning in general can be very, very specific. So anything that's, you know, there's been stories of baseball pitchers that have been screwed up from using a baseball that's just a little bit heavier, just a little bit lighter, you know, and you're much better off going to something that's more dramatically different, trying to alter those fine motor skills that the guy has invested, you know, thousands and thousands of reps to get it down to such a fine precision, and you may just screw that all up by deciding to use a baseball that's just a little bit heavier, you know. So
you're saying do it more extreme when you're changing it up? Don't just barely?
Yeah. Help. Yeah, so that so that the body can probably distinguish it as another motor task. So if the pitcher goes out and throws, you know, a heavy medicine ball, you know, it may not be that bad because in his brain and his nervous system, he's associated that. Well, that's a completely different motion. You know, that's a medicine ball. I mean, that's heavy. It's huge. There's no way I can throw that like a baseball. But now you give him a baseball that's maybe just a couple ounces heavier and tell him, okay, now I want you to do most of your practice throwing this. Ah, that's just a bad idea.
So what about in sports like powerlifting where you're, you know, let's say you're competing in the bench press, but you're using bands or adding chains to the weight. You know, is that altering it enough? Or what about West Side's theory? You know, they take different max effort exercises, but they're all, you know, a different kind of pressing. You know, you think they're changing enough each time, or are some of those too similar that it could be messing you up?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what you're looking at is how similar is it, and we're looking for what's called positive transfer. So if I, for example, I just started doing a cycle with band deadlifts, and the band is at the bottom. And what I'm interested in, I haven't quite finished it yet, is I definitely got stronger in that exercise. So I started a really light weight, just using the lead FTS, so just the average orange band at the bottom.
Right.
And I was able to, over 3 months, increase my weight in that exercise by, you know, well over 100 pounds. Which,
in the band exercise, right?
In the banded exercise, exactly. So the key question is, okay, so I definitely made progress in that. And the next question is, does it transfer to increasing my normal deadlift without bands? I haven't retested my deadlift yet, so I can't really say. But, I mean, I think the guys at Westside and other, you know, lifters have, you know, done it enough that it definitely does appear to transfer a fair amount. And I think it, as you're a more advanced lifter, it's probably just enough of a different stimulus to maybe provoke maybe an adaptation and then test it again to see if it transfers. And that's really hard because I think it comes down to an individual level. So I took a period of time where my sumo deadlift was not as good as my conventional. And I added a whole bunch of weight to my sumo deadlift, and my conventional deadlift stayed right about the same.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that a lot from people. It's just very, very different muscles being used.
But other guys will do it
the other way around, though. I've heard if you do conventional deadlift, will help your sumo go up, but doing sumo will not help your conventional. That's what some guys from my gym have said.
Yeah. So all those are just starting points, unfortunately, for you to perform your own little experiment. You know, take a set period of time, do it, make sure you get stronger in that lift, and then at the end of it, test it. you know, did my, you know, regular deadlift get better? If it didn't,
we wish someone
well,
else could just do the test for us, because who's got time to do like 2 months of just one exercise if they're trying to plan for a meet or doing something to see if doing that just one thing is going to help their max?
Oh, so yeah.
It's like we need guinea pigs or something.
Yeah, and yeah, that's the hardest part. I think it's a little woo-woo. If you do an exercise and your movement, or your overall movement quality is better, I think the odds of it positively transferring are better. If you do a movement, like deadlift, bench, whatever, it doesn't matter, and your overall movement quality gets worse, I don't think that's probably going to help you move towards your goal as fast.
What do you mean by movement quality?
Here's an example. So if you have a guy who's going to do a deadlift, and let's say you're watching him, and it's a real grinder. It doesn't look very good at all. His back's kind of flexed. He's turning red, tons of tension. Looks like his spine's going to shoot halfway across the gym or whatever. But he makes it. Right? He grinds it out, maybe hitches a little bit at the end, you know, probably not legal, but he made the lift, so to speak. And he drops the weight. You kind of watch him walk away from that, and it doesn't look very good. Doesn't look like any person I want to walk around as. You know, the right leg is kind of dragging a little bit, kind of bent over. He made the lift. He executed it. Maybe it was, you know, competition standard or not, debatable. But he sure as hell destroyed the quality of his movement in the process, right? He's not moving right. Well. The odds of him doing another deadlift that day are pretty much slim to none. So he's pretty much gone beyond where he should have gone.
Now, would that have maybe been like 100% one rep max or something? Which you don't want to practice movements like that. You want to save that for the meet and keep your form good during practice?
Yes, I would say it's definitely related to that, because I think the problem is, in a perfect world, you'd want to do that, but I don't think you would want it to degrade your movement so bad that you couldn't perform it again. Does that make sense?
Right.
So if we slide back on the spectrum and go, okay, let's do some more lifts at 80%. Oh, let's do, you know, double 80%. Okay, that's pretty good. My movement's still pretty good. You can measure it by gait, range of motion, grip test, whatever measure I want to use. And my movement's still good. Well, I can probably do that movement again, right? So your body is always going to get better at what you practice. So if you're practicing a lift and your movement is still good at the end of it, I think that's going to be much more beneficial. Is that going to help a little bit?
Yeah, that's a good point. Opposite spectrum of, let's say you're one of the guys that misses them a lot. Like you're training, you always end your workout going for a one rep max and you just keep missing those. Are you? What does that do to your pattern?
Yeah, you're
buddy.
You're in essence learning to fail. You're literally teaching your body that, you know, whatever weight, you know, deadlift 400 pounds or 600 pounds, whatever the weight is, if you go in and you keep repeatedly miss it, you'll see guys who I'm sure you've seen with bench press all the time. You're literally telling your body that you cannot perform this lift. And you go to try it again, miss again. What did you just tell your brain? He told you couldn't lift it.
So how does that happen? Like, why is that happening?
It can happen for various reasons. The way to get around it is to be successful in your lifts, right? And I'm sure you've talked to a lot of elite lifters, right? You know, how often do they ever intentionally miss a lift? Or how often do they even miss a lift, period?
They almost always cut it off before they miss something. If
yeah.
they miss something, it's because something was wrong that day. Like they had an off day.
Sure.
Like they were tired. They didn't eat good. Something happened and they missed it and it was not supposed to happen. And then they're done. The workout's over anyway. But nobody purposely keeps going up and going up and going up. And that's with guys that are competing. And, you know, if somebody's really, really hyped up and everyone else sees, you know, that was pretty close to where you need to stop, people tell them to stop.
Yep.
And they're just done. But if you go to a normal commercial gym and you might see the same guy every Monday night maxing out on different lifts and missing it every single time, and it just keeps doing it over and over. But, yeah, it's like a gradual thing. You want to just make little tiny incremental gains over time.
Yep.
Try not to too often, for sure. I guess it was just I don't know why we don't do it. People, you just got passed down. You know, you don't want it.
Well,
saying
I think
not.
it's ego lifting.
Yeah. I mean, forced reps. What's a forced rep then? Is that something that's going to hurt you?
Yeah, I'd be pretty careful with that. That's my biased opinion.
I've heard about people using it as a bodybuilding technique, but when it comes to strength training, people don't use it very often. When you're done, you're done, people. If you go halfway up the bench and you miss it, they don't make you grind it out. When you're done, everyone just takes the weight.
Yep, no, exactly. And, you know, like you said, the key point is that, you know, those guys don't ever plan on missing a weight. Does it happen? Yeah, it'll happen on occasion. But like you said, then they're done. You know, they don't go, oh, I can make it this time, miss. Oh, the third time, yep. No, just come back another day. Don't keep teaching your brain that you can't lift this.
But some guys do keep doing it over and over, but they usually don't really get past that weight.
Exactly.
That's kind of scary.
Yeah, they taught their brain that they can't do it. Literally, that's what it is. They have literally done so many reps that their brain goes, oh, I don't think you can do that.
How do you override it? Take a step back and just work past it?
Yep. If you're constantly, I don't know if it was like Craig or Frankie came up with this, if you're constantly seeking your limits, you will find them. If you work within your limits, you will expand them, right? And you all know this from bench press, right? Yeah, nobody goes into the in bench press as their max every single day. One, it doesn't happen.
Right.
And then two, that's teaching your body that you have limits, right? Because you go every day, and this is what most people do in the gym. You go, I'm going to go and I'm going to find my limit today. Well, yeah, you'll find it. But how much progress did you make? You know, these are the same people who reach plateaus and never get by them. They're stuck at the same plateau. And it's like, yeah, you got to, you know, take a step back. You know, go to 90%, 80%. You know, an indicator, like I'm sure you've read before and used, is bar speed, right? If you, let's say your max today is 300 on a bench, and you get up to, you know, 275, and you make it, and it's kind of a grinder, and it's pretty slow. The odds of you making 300 that day, probably not, right? Because
right.
the bar speed was slow. So you walk up, and you smoke 275 like nothing. Yeah, go up in weight. So.
Yeah, that's why in the meets, when you have the three attempts, everybody usually knows their opener.
Yep.
A lot of times the second one, you've got your second attempt picked, and hopefully it's some kind of personal record, and you go for that. But nobody knows their third attempt because you need the other people to check out your second attempt, make it, need to see it, see how fast the ball is moving, and see how you look that day. Because you want to get your second attempt. You know, everybody wants to. That's usually the one that sets a PR for yourself, and then the third is just like a little extra gravy on top sometimes, but you don't know what that's going to be. You don't know what kind of day it's going to be.
Oh, yeah, and I'm sure you talk to people all the time that, you know, that they'll miss their opener, you know, and then mentally they're hosed, and it's just like,
that's screwed.
Just take something light. Your opener, and I'm sure you guys have preached on this over and over, and I actually have people practice this. Your opening weight should be something you can do in your sleep with, you could drop someone in by helicopter, slept for 2 hours, and they should be able to hit their opener, right? Doesn't matter what condition, doesn't matter what you ate, it should be easy enough that under any condition you have no questions asked, you can hit it.
Yeah, you're
so you
right.
Go into the,
oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so you go into the meet knowing that, okay, I got my opener for sure. You know, the second one, exactly what you said, hopefully it's a PR, hopefully it's pretty good. But people get greedy a lot of times on their second rep and go, well, my opener was a little bit heavier than I thought. It was a little slow, but, you know, on my little piece of paper I made 12 weeks ago, it says I need to hit this number, and they're not even close.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the other thing that can throw off your opener, you know, at our gym we compete with the gear, with powerlifting gear, just supportive.
Sure.
It helps you lift more weight, but it also takes practice getting it dialed in. And then that's where the opener can get tricky because it takes a certain amount of weight to manipulate that gear that you're wearing. And that's when a lot of geared lifters get into problems.
Oh, yeah. And unfortunately, whatever you're competing in is what you would need to practice some in. Not saying all your lifts have to be geared, obviously. But
then
you want enough practice that you can do it.
Right, and then you have people cutting weight and putting weight back on. They don't put all the weight back on, or they're a lot lighter, and now their gear fits different. And it just throws people off. So.
Yep, and in a perfect world, you would do that in training too. So
right.
Take, you know, 4 to 8 weeks out and say, okay, I'm going to try and replicate the same conditions. I'm going to cut weight. And tomorrow is just gym day, but I'm going to put all my gear on and, you know, try and replicate a meet condition and see where I'm at.
Yeah, it's really
you
strange.
You find out that.
In any sport, it seems, why change and do things differently all of a sudden, you know, during competition? I did an interview the other day with a bodybuilding competitor, and he was talking about diet prior to a bodybuilding competition. He was like, telling how people ate clean and good and their stomachs and everything was used to the food they were eating. And then all of a sudden, 1 week before the show, they start doing all these crazy things trying to just get an extra bit more cut, and then it can backfire on them because their body's not used to it. I mean, it seems like it happens in a lot of sports. Like a week or so, everybody starts panicking, getting nervous, and then they just totally start doing different things they're not used to, trying a supplement they never tried, like the day of eating, stuff like that. It's kind of funny.
I mean, most people I work with under those conditions, like, I mean, my whole job is, like, basically go, don't, they call up in the middle of the night, hey, I should try caffeine before I lift. No? Do you try in training? No, but you've even told me there's research showing that it'll help me increase my strength. Well, yeah, but you've never done it in training, so you don't know how you're going to respond to it, but do it the day before a competition. Well, I think it's really going to help me. It's all this time just trying to talk them out of crazy ass stuff they're going to try to do.
It's funny. People just get hyper and excited, nervous.
Yeah,
it's like people
talking
about caffeine pills. They're like, should I take 3 caffeine pills? I'm like, I've never seen you take more than one. Don't take 3 now. 3 now, like, no, you've never done it before. Don't do it.
Oh yeah, it's kind of the model of eustress training versus distress training. You know, distress training would be, you know, practicing a lift under different conditions. If you're going to use caffeine and it's allowed, and, you know, then use it in training beforehand, you know, to know how you react to it and that type of thing. So, but yeah, everyone wants
things
to try something
mix
new.
Differently, you know, the day of any sport or event, I mean, you've got some different adrenaline going. You're not in the environment you're used to. The same stuff you usually do is still going to feel different. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and even, I'm sure the first powerlifting meet I ever did a couple of years ago, they allowed you to bring music. So I gave the guy CDs I was going to lift to, and I'm like, oh, that's cool. And the second meet I did about 2 years later was through a federation where they didn't, or at least this particular one, didn't have any music. So I walked out there, and it was just a push-pull. Bench press, I didn't notice it too much. But for deadlift, I walk out, and I look at all these people, and all of a sudden, they like, cut the music. And I'm like, oh, my God, you could hear, like, a pin drop in here. And I was like, whoa, that's just, I hadn't trained that way. I hadn't even thought about it. And I show up on the day, and I'm like, oh, wow. And you wouldn't think something as minor as just music makes a difference. But when you're spending all your time training one way and you're not prepared for it, it does make a difference.
Yeah, and people get all superstitious, and they want certain songs playing and certain volume and stuff like that. I mean, you got certain guys that they're trying to do a lift, but they want to turn the music up. They want this certain song on. I'm like, what happens at the meet if the stereo's broken, or like they're playing some song you don't like or something like that? Are you going to not be able to do the lift? Like, why not train under worse circumstances so that when you're there, you're more comfortable? I mean, that's the approach I used to take for football, having played in college. I mean, if you're out in the summer doing hill sprints and doing things in the heat, that's going to be way worse than you show up to camp. All of a sudden, it's not so bad anymore.
Yeah, no, that's totally true, especially for heat acclimation. And, you know, I worked with one person who's a marathon runner who I just did a one-off session on her. She's in the Olympics in China. And she's like, what do I do to prepare for the heat and the altitude and everything? I'm like, just get there as soon as you can. You know, the reality is there's some stuff you can do to try and simulate
it. What are those chambers called? So you go to Colorado.
Yeah.
Or what are those sleep chambers where?
Oh, yeah, the oxygen deprivation usually. Or do they have like high altitude tents and that type of stuff? But yeah, even for heat and stuff, it's just get there and train in it as soon as you can. I mean, that's, you know, if you're going to compete under these types of conditions, then at least train under it somewhat. That's not saying that all your training has to be involved in that. Just enough so that you know you can perform under that condition. So, But yeah,
what about morning and nights? Does that make any difference? Like, if you always
yeah.
practice at night, but then the event is at like 8 o'clock in the morning, and you're not used to that.
Yeah, I mean, there's been more than one powerlifter I've talked to is like, oh yeah, it was a 2-hour drive and it was a morning lift. I got there and oh, my hips are so sore, I couldn't move, and it's like, well, yeah, but you knew that going in, right? And not that it's going to be perfect, but maybe at home, sit in front of your computer for 2.5 hours and then go to the gym in the morning and see how it goes.
Right.
You know, and yeah. People are like, well, that's just crazy. I'm like, but you're just trying to replicate it to see how your body responds to it. And from a mental confidence standpoint, I think it's huge. Because if you do that and you do it and you perform well, then your whole drive up, you're like, oh, yeah, I did this before. No problem.
Yeah, just
you know, instead of going, oh, my God, I'm scared out of my mind. What's going to happen? My hips hurt. Ah!
Yeah. Get there the night before, too. You're kind of worried about missing
oh,
the
yeah.
week, getting stuck in traffic and extra stress.
Oh, yeah. The one I did recently in Duluth, I even left at, like, freaking 11:30 at night because I was going to see Henry Rollins perform and still wanted to see him. And so my wife and I drove up, you know, that night. You know, we go to bed at, like, 2:30 in the morning. You know, luckily the lift was a little bit later, started at 10, but I felt better doing that, knowing that I was there at the location instead of
right.
trying to drive up in the morning, worried about, oh, what happened to traffic, and oh no, I got a flat tire, you know, all the things that you probably would never happen, but you keep thinking in your head may happen, so.
Yeah, exactly. So this turned into a powerlifting interview halfway through. Go figure.
Yeah, I figure it probably kind of always does, doesn't it?
You're writing the protein chapter right now. Tell us some of the stuff that's going on with you, where people can get a hold of you and stuff, what you're working on. Hello?
Sorry, my mic's on a little weird. My headset died.
Okay.
Yep, so
got
finishing
you.
That
got
up.
Back.
Okay. Also working on a product for the metabolic flexibility. So I'll probably do a live seminar probably in a couple months or so. And, yeah, just working on graduating hopefully sometime this year. And shameless promotion, you can check out my blog at extremehumanperformance.com too. So I have all the updates on there. May have some more webinars coming out in the future too. So yeah.
Okay, cool. Definitely want to hear about those. The relentless pursuit of your next personal record. I like the tagline.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I subconsciously stole it from Charles Daly.
Ah.
I was like reading his blog, like this was literally like a couple of weeks ago, and I was looking, and his tagline is very similar, and I'm like, oh my God, I think I stole that from, so I sent him an email, I'm like, I think I stole your tagline, so I'm changing it, and he's like, oh, okay.
Well,
I'm like, I really didn't mean to, I'm sorry.
Well, that's a cool tagline regardless.
Yeah, thanks.
We'll have to think of a better one, I guess.
Yeah, they can send me any ideas they have.
You go into any events? We first met at a conference in Connecticut a couple years ago. Are you going to the Olympia or anything?
No, I'd like to, but I'm still trying to work on getting done first. I did go to the ISSN, International Society of Sports Nutrition, conference in June down in Florida. That was a lot of fun. It was a very good time. First time I had been down there. So hopefully plan to hit a few more conferences next year for sure, though.
Sounds good. Hopefully I'll see you at one of those. We can meet up.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for talking with us. Really appreciate it. Learned a lot.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. I'll talk to you real soon. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Mike.